brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
You're listening to CHM Live Radio. I'm Chanel Lauren, and I produce the museum's live speaker series. Each year, we bring incredible guests to the museum to talk about computing and the transformational effects it's having on our society. We've hosted a wide range of speakers, from geneticists and asteroid miners.
I am worried about sustainability if we don't draw resources from space.
To technology giants like Elon Musk and Sheryl Sandberg.
Not everyone can join the high-tech rocket ship industry, but there are areas of every company, of every industry, where your skills are more important and there's a growing need for them.
Do entrepreneurs have to choose between purpose and profit? Julie Hanna says no. She's the executive chair of Kiva, one of the world's largest crowd lending marketplaces. Kiva has provided 1 million loans to almost 3 million borrowers around the world. These loans add up to $1 billion, and they are paid back 97% of the time. In this episode, we'll hear from Julie Hanna about her vision for the future of investing and her views on technology's democratizing potential.
The products that I built, the companies that I helped build, were all about democratizing access to information, democratizing communication, collaboration, and doing that on a mass scale, because if you think about kind of what technology uniquely can do is it's an accelerator and it can achieve a global scale. So that was always what was fueling me.
So how is Kiva enabling innovation while making money? How can corporations shift to a purpose-driven profit model? And do governments have a role in supporting underserved entrepreneurs? Find out in this conversation between Julie Hanna and the museum's Exponential Center Executive Director, Marguerite Gong Hancock. It was recorded in November of 2016.
I'd like to start with the beginning of your story, your personal story. You describe yourself as a war refugee and also an immigrant. Can you take us back to that part of your story?
Well, first of all, thank you for the warm welcome. Good evening, everyone. At some point, I realized it's like Steve Jobs said, that you can only connect the dots on your life in hindsight. And at some point, I did connect the dots between having begun my journey on the front lines of war and ending up on the front lines of the tech revolution, and realized that experiences that I had very early in my life very much shaped my values and my belief system and dreams that had fueled my work as a technologist. And specifically, there were these sort of key moments. I think all of us can think back to our childhoods, and there are these moments that stay with us, and we're not really sure why. And I've realized that they are, either have taught us something, or they've left an imprint, even sort of neurological patterns and wiring in our brain. For me, those experiences were the fleeing the war in Black September, which was a war in Jordan in 1970, with my classmates as army tanks opened fire on our one-room schoolhouse, and never seeing my classmates again. And I was very lucky. I found my family, and we escaped in the countryside and eventually found refuge in Lebanon. But the memory that stayed with me, and I thought over my life, sort of wondered what happened to my classmates. And one thing I realized is that probably the most important difference between us as human beings is the access to opportunity that I got. And then when we came to the States, another kind of real defining moment for me was that, you know, coming to the States was a moment of hope, building kind of a new life in a new land. But that hope quickly turned to struggle. I watched my parents, they were educated, they were resourceful, but they couldn't find work. We didn't have a place to live. And there were very nice and generous people that helped us in those moments. But there were these things that I never understood that kind of stayed with me. And for the better part of my life, I would go back to kind of reflecting on this look in those nice people's eyes, a look I'd never seen before, an expression on my parents' face I'd never seen before, and a feeling that was very unfamiliar to me. I'd never had. And for the, it's taken me the better part of a lifetime to realize that that look I saw in their eyes was pity.
Pity.
And that my parents, what I was watching with them is their dignity being chipped away. And the feeling that I was having was that I didn't know how to explain to myself as a child was shame. And so those experiences really made me dream about a different future. And there was a gift, in a hidden gift in that. The words I would put to it now that I didn't have at the time was I dreamt of a world that understands that pity is the near enemy of compassion. That talent is universal, but opportunity isn't. And that, you know, I dreamt of a world that regards dignity as an inalienable human right. And most of all, I came to think that a cornerstone of justice is fair access, the kind of access that my family had trouble getting. And so I tell that story not because it's unique, it's really the story of millions and hundreds of millions of people. But I use my voice to tell it because they can't, and also because it really did shape my view of technology when I came to Silicon Valley, seeing it as a democratizing force, as it being able to enable fair access. And so that's really kind of my accidental journey as an entrepreneur.
Well, thank you for sharing that remarkable journey. Let's fast forward to the early 90s when you came to Silicon Valley and became a technologist. You were actually here in this building, I think, when this was Silicon Graphics, so welcome back.
Yeah.
So can you share with us about some of those defining moments as a technologist, your experiences in the Valley during those days? It was the early days, a wave of the internet, and how that piece as a technologist then added on to your essential kind of mission.
Well, it's always been about democratization for me. So all the products that I built, the companies that I helped build, were all about democratizing access to information, democratizing communication, collaboration, and doing that on a mass scale. Because if you think about kind of what technology uniquely can do, is it's an accelerator and it can achieve a global scale. So that was always what was fueling me. And then with Kiva, it's been all about democratization of capital, particularly reaching sort of the most underserved, riskiest parts of the world. So that's really the red thread in terms of my work and here in Silicon Valley. I think from the beginning, particularly with the internet, you know, if you think about, we often talk about the dehumanizing impact of technology, but I see also its humanizing potential. And, what used to only be possible locally is now global. What's global feels local. And it's reminding us of how interconnected we are. And the internet, to me, is one giant organism, and human beings are the nodes on that organism. And, like the butterfly effect, where one tiny action in one part of the world can have, sort of a ripple effect, that's the world we live in today, and we see that every day, whether it's in the form of a viral video that makes its way around the world in an instant, or the speed with which revolutions come to fruition, like in my homeland of Egypt. So that's the potential that I see. If you think about today, there are almost as many cell phone subscriptions as there are people on the planet, and 1.5 billion more than have access to a toilet. And it took about 20 years for that to happen. And there are almost 4 billion people on the internet, almost 2 billion people on Facebook. Facebook, to me, has become the human operating system. That took about 10 years to happen. And so I think we're living at a time where we have a unique opportunity, because in our hands, in technology and business, are the two most powerful tools ever invented, I believe. And at the same time, we're faced with existential threats and some of the greatest challenges that humanity's ever been faced with. And we have a unique opportunity to marry those two things to address these mass-scale issues that have always felt intractable, until now. And so the question that I'm iteratively asking is, how can we marry our vision for technology and business and align that with our vision for humanity?
That is the question of the night, and it's a question that has to be on people's minds if we're going to address being able to lift people out of poverty, to give access. Can you give us some examples? We've talked a little bit about Kiva. Can you give us some other specific examples of entrepreneurs or companies that are marrying technology and business in compelling ways?
If you think about how, as entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, we disrupt markets, we always start with an underserved market that's overlooked and oftentimes thought to be, you know, not a very attractive market because all the incumbents and the big guys have sought, you know, sort of the low-hanging fruit. And then we nibble our way up to disrupt kind of the broader market. So if you think about the fact that there are 4 billion people on the internet, which means that another 4 billion are not on the internet, that is an underserved market, an unmet need. And we're living in a mobile-first world where mobile is leapfrogging in the hardline internet. And so you look at World Reader with their vision to make everybody literate and provide the ability to read on mobile devices. That's so compelling because it starts with the underserved market, but there's no reason why that can't be the way we do it for the globe. And you could argue it's the world's largest underserved market. Look at companies like Andela, who are essentially identifying, sort of training top technical talent in Africa and fueling or supplying that talent here in Silicon Valley to companies where there's a war for talent, and expanding that pie. We have an expanding pie here. We can't get enough people here, but all of a sudden now you can expand that pie to a place like Africa because, again, talent is universal. Segovia, which is solving the problem of how money gets to these parts of the world. There's about $400 billion that goes to aid the poor. And because that happens in largely an analog way, you can imagine all the failure points, all the corruption, all of the accountability, the tracking, it doesn't get in the right hands, all that. So Segovia is automating all of that. Those are some of the really exciting large-scale sort of things that I see out there that are incredible. There's a lot of things that are being built on around mobile money. If you go to Kenya, you feel like you're visiting the future. Everything is digital. M-Pesa is ubiquitous. You go to the remotest villages in the shanty towns in Kibera, the largest slum in Africa, and everybody has an M-Pesa sign on their business, and you realize they're way beyond where we are.
These are great successes to talk about, and we know that for people and companies that are disrupting models, disrupting markets, that success is not always the way. For people who are aspiring or starting out their journey and who may not have found success yet, what are some of the pitfalls that you've seen to avoid, or some of the challenges that entrepreneurs in this space may be able to learn from other people's lessons?
As entrepreneurs, I think fundamentally the essence of entrepreneurship, it's a mindset first, and some of us choose it as a vocation. And that mindset is really about the relentless pursuit of a better way. It's about a future that you want to live in, that you see ahead of other people, and it's an inherent dissatisfaction with the status quo. And so oftentimes the things that we're most passionate about are born out of very deeply personal experiences or pain points or something we've witnessed or an injustice we want to right, and that's also universally relevant. So when the personal becomes universal, big ideas can be unlocked. Now, when we're trying to solve problems for parts of the world that are unfamiliar to us, one of the things that we can do is we can sort of fall victim to projecting our own assumptions about how to solve those problems. And I think this is a lot of what happens when very well-intentioned NGOs go into other parts of the world. We can be very ethnocentric in the way we seek to solve those problems. We can be paternalistic in the way we seek to solve them. You know, all the scrutiny, I think, you know, for a decade now, one of the questions that Kiev is always being asked and we're always trying to answer for ourselves is, you know, do these small loans really have an impact on people's lives? This has always sort of been the big question around microfinance and small loans. And I find that a puzzling question, because no one doubts that loans help people in the West. We never ask that question. And we don't look for one loan to completely change someone's life here. You know, debt and loans are about expansion, and they're a part of the fabric of the way our society functions. We know that they're inherently important to growth, whether it's growing someone's personal capacity or the economy at large. But yet we take this sort of more paternalistic approach and kind of say, did that loan really help this person living on less than $2 a day? And when you're there on the ground, you see it's an unequivocal yes.
Yes.
So I think those are some of the pitfalls. So I think it's that bringing the humility, and one of the things that we've tried to do at Kiva, and the entrepreneurs that succeed on the ground are the ones that go and understand and really exercise what I think is the key to building great products and companies, is radical empathy, which is crawling into the mind of the person you're trying to build your product for and really understanding how it fits into the overall ecosystem of how they live and is it really enhancing. And it's a kind of a radical and deep study of choice and consequence, and understanding that in a holistic way is probably kind of one of the most important things, I think.
Wise words. I love that, radical empathy. Well, we're really pleased that we're part of Global Entrepreneurship Week, and I'd like to turn now to your role that you've had in being an ambassador, and in fact, a presidential ambassador for global entrepreneurship. Can you tell us a little bit about what that role has been? What have you focused on in that role?
The role was born out of President Obama's insight that entrepreneurship, the way that it is celebrated and supported and the role it plays in the economy in the U.S. is something that we are universally admired for as a country. And that if we can export it to parts of the country that can uplift city economies or other parts of the world, then ultimately that can play a vital role in providing economic stability. And you can't really get nation stability without economic stability. So ultimately, it could play a role in a proactive path to peace. And so that's the charter was really around how to help export and develop the next generation of entrepreneurs around the world and in the U.S., particularly in parts of the country where or parts of the world where you have youth bulge, high youth unemployment. In the Middle East, it's nearly 70% of people are under 30. Lots of parts of the world are like this, and with no prospect for jobs or employment. So if you can ignite a possibility around entrepreneurship as a path, then, you know, this gives people hope, a sense of agency. And we've certainly seen that with Kiva entrepreneurs, that when they get the loans and they're able to build their businesses, there's the capital and how their life improves materially, but there's also kind of a dignity building that occurs that's really incredibly powerful and poignant. And so that's really kind of the essence of the role. It's part advocacy, part policy advisor. We travel to places like Kenya with the president earlier this year to Cuba, which is a really interesting experience because
Tell us a little bit about one of those trips.
Well, in Cuba, being an entrepreneur was illegal when we were there. And so it was very interesting. We had an entrepreneurship summit. The president spoke. We all spoke. And it's a technically illegal thing, so there's a very strange experience. What was interesting is a couple of months later, the government changed the laws to make it legal. And it was a sort of really profound turning point moment to see, so again, on the one extreme. So it's really about helping ignite entrepreneurship, be advocates for it, be models for it.
As I understand it, each ambassador has a specific initiative. Can you tell us about the initiatives that you've had in the past and what you're focused on?
Yeah, we each had a signature initiative. Mine was focused around access to capital and particularly one in support of women and young entrepreneurs. So last year's charter was to drive $100 million to reach 200,000 women and young entrepreneurs across the world, all crowdfunded through Kiva. And this summer at the 1 year mark, we actually ended up reaching almost 300,000 entrepreneurs and $108 million. So it's a real testament to kind of the scale potential of crowdfunding.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations. For the roles of government, many governments are trying in their own ways to support entrepreneurship. Some have been wildly successful and some not. Certain government roles are really enable and enhance, and other times government entrepreneurs say gets in the way. What can you say about what you think are some of the best strategies that governments can use to support entrepreneurship?
In many ways, really the best thing that government can do is, you know, get out of the way. If you think about entrepreneurship is inherently a bottoms-up activity, and government is fundamentally top-down. And so sometimes the government's attempt to help can undermine really what needs to sort of, or what is trying to happen organically, naturally. But I think if you that's sort of a bit tongue-in-cheek, although also partly serious.
Spoken as a true entrepreneur.
Yeah, so in some ways I think entrepreneurs are, they're the world's greatest change agents to me. I think it's the most powerful way to move the human ecosystem forward, to advance our evolution. And it's a subversive act in a way. I mean, we're a form of activist. And so in terms of government, the question, what role does government play fundamentally? It's about what do you incentivize, what do you disincentivize, and then how can you convene people? So incentivizing and disincentivizing comes down to laws, right? How do you, in certain parts of the world, how do you decriminalize failure? You know, that's the thing that in the U.S. we do very well, particularly in a place like California. You can take, you're incentivizing risk. You are enabling a cultural mindset that also destigmatizes the mindset around failure and viewing it as experimentation. And so you can't have innovation without risk. They're two halves of a whole. And so that's one key role that government can play. But I fundamentally think it starts with the mindset shifts first, because policy always follows innovation, not the other way around. So mainly it's about seeing where are the blocks to enabling people to take risk and to start something, and then removing those barriers.
You've talked about sort of the roles that people can play in these leadership positions, and many people look to Silicon Valley as a leader, not only for technology innovation, but social innovation. And some might say that we have a particular responsibility and opportunity to use the resources and technologies that are here to play a larger role to serve this. What would you say to that in terms of what the challenges and opportunities are for people and leaders here in Silicon Valley to serve the next billion through entrepreneurship?
Well, yeah, one observation I remember having at some point, and that question that's come out of it for me is, as Silicon Valley goes, so does the world. Mm-hmm. That's the clear trend line. And so it raises the question, what does Silicon Valley mean to the world? And with that power, what is the joy of responsibility look like? And particularly in an era when we are ushering in some really powerful tools with AI and robotics and automation, and we know what's coming. I mean, we tend to, the saying we all have around here is we tend to overestimate the short-term impact of technology but underestimate its long-term impact. I've started to wonder if that's not actually going to flip for the first time because of what's coming. Mm-hmm. And the The other thing that, you know, we often talk about is the future is here, it's just unevenly distributed. And so how can we use the technology in the future that is here to distribute it more evenly to reach people who aren't on the internet yet? Because if we don't find a way, you know, I think one of the things that we're seeing consequence of in this country, around the world, is the velocity of change that technology's ushered in. Those of us who thrive in that can very much luxuriate in the techno-utopian view of the world, and we can look at all the wonderful things about it, and how, and it can also blind us to people who aren't thriving in that. And so I think, you know, a lot of what's been what's happening in the country in this election cycle is fundamentally anchored in one anchor is that. Then you go kind of look globally and say, what does it mean when you are going at such a speed, but you're not bringing a critical mass of people with you? What is the consequence of that? I loved that Mark Zuckerberg this year at Mobile World Congress was imploring everyone that, you know, while we're thinking about how to get faster internet access for rich people, let's not forget about the 4 billion people who don't have it at all. And so I think that kind of a mindset becomes really, really important. So when we think about how we're going to automate jobs, let's also think about how we help people retool and come along in an economy, because transportation, the implications of the transportation jobs that are going to go away, for example, with driverless cars, are so astronomical, it's almost like you can't wrap your head around it. I think one of the hardest things about all of this is that it's really hard to, like, if this group of people was the world's population, half of you would be living on less than $2 a day. And it's a hard thing to grasp that a system that we benefit from so much can leave so many people out. And it's an easy thing to disconnect from. And yet, I think if we can bring ourselves to connect with it, there are some very easy, straightforward things that we can do to affect mass change. And we, you know, the ethos of the Valley, what I fell in love with when I came here in the early 90s, is that the soul of the Valley was about change the world, you know, long before that became a cliche on the show Silicon Valley. So it's, how do we reclaim that soul of thinking about solving these mass scale problems? Those are some of the questions that I ask myself.
Well, that's a great call to action for us to have the soul that's really thinking about what's most important and using the tools and resources that we have to serve people. Of course, Silicon Valley isn't the only place where there are keen entrepreneurs and innovative ideas. As you look internationally at other hotspots, where do you see as places that are have sort of burgeoning and dynamic, fertile areas for entrepreneurs?
Well, you know, that used to be an easier question to answer because, you know, you could sort of cite off, oh, London, Berlin, Stockholm. Now there are so many. It in some ways it's sort of like become one of the world's largest movements. But you know, some surprising spots. Nairobi actually is a very interesting hub of entrepreneurship.
Say more about that. Help paint that picture. Why would you pick Nairobi? What's happening there? And maybe you could introduce us to an entrepreneur or a company that gives some kind of flesh around that story.
I think part of it, one of the most entrepreneurial and interesting places I ever visited was Kibera, the slum outside of Nairobi. And, you know, when you first go there, of course, your eyes drawn to the physicality of it, and, you know, it's a slum, and there's no sanitation, and you can sort of think, oh, this is kind of this, you know, difficult place to be. But it belies that it's this hyper-networked, innovative environment. I think estimates of how big it is vary, but somewhere between 170,000 to half a million or more, depending on how it's counted, people. And the way they live, the way they are interdependent, it reminded me a little bit of Silicon Valley. It was just so tightly networked ecosystem and super innovative. And so I think part of it is born out of that. Part of it is born out of the fact that it's a backyard for a lot of social enterprises and NGOs to come and do things. And so there's always this kind of dynamism around that. I don't know exactly the roots of it, but it's, and the government has really sort of focused on it as well, but it's really exciting to see what's happening there. Andela is based there, and I know when Mark Zuckerberg was in Africa, he went to visit. He's an investor in Andela. There's some really interesting, and actually one of the things we found with Kiva that is, in addition to making these loans directly to individual entrepreneurs and borrowers, is that social enterprises that are there on the ground are also great borrowers on Kiva. So if you're, you know, if you're trying to bring a solar light to a dark part of Africa, that's a great enterprise to fund through Kiva, in addition to the people buying the solar lights. So yeah,
there's this virtuous relationship and network that happens.
Yeah, it's all about building ecosystems. Like, you know, Solar Sisters, one of the Kiva partner and one of the organization I love the most, they have these solar lamps, and their idea was, okay, we'll create a distribution network, that last mile of distributing our product, by having women be partners, our distribution, our channel, essentially. So then they get the lights, they have a source of income. And it's just like the ecosystems we built here. The problem they ran into is that their potential part, the women that would be at the partner, didn't have the capital to buy the lights. And so that's where the Kiva loans came in. So you get this like multiplicative sort of effect.
For those who aren't familiar with Kiva, I'd love to hear a few other stories of the ways that Kiva has worked, both the lenders and the entrepreneurs, and how this has become a really powerful engine for creating an ecosystem globally. Can you tell us about some of the individual lives that have been impacted?
Yeah, it's there's 2.1 million, and each story is more remarkable than the other. You mentioned the first borrower, Elizabeth Omala. She's a Ugandan fishmonger, widowed mother of five. I call Elizabeth the godmother of crowdfunding. One of the most memorable for me was a loan that I made early on, and it was a beautiful picture of these young Cambodian women sitting in a row, and they had a sewing co-op raising money for sewing machines, $700 for sewing machines. And then when I read their story, I learned that they had been rescued from sex trafficking. And all of a sudden, the sewing machine kind of takes on a whole symbolism. The loan is no longer just a loan. The sewing machine is a tool for a hopeful future away from a tragic past. And when they repaid their loan, it wasn't about the money. I realized the money is just a connection, because it told me, oh, I played some small role in their life becoming that much more viable. So, and then, you know, here in our own backyard, I think one of the more rock star entrepreneurs is a woman named Teresa Goines. She was a corrections officer that worked with kids in juvie hall, and she decided to start a 1940 supper club called Old School Cafe in Hunters Point Bayview area to give kids that had gone to prison or tangled with the law jobs and a future beyond prison. And today she's got dreams of starting Old School Cafes all over the country. There's a company called Cooley Cooley in the East Bay that makes moringa juice, and they got their first loan through Kiva, and I just learned recently that they've got a national distribution agreement with Whole Foods. So these are great stories for how kind of Kiva can be an on-ramp for entrepreneurs sort of at the riskiest stage and to prove their viability. But probably the maybe one worth mentioning is a man named Erastus Kamani, who I met in Kenya, and it took hours to reach him down a dirt road. And Morogo, Kenya, is really more of a settlement than anything. It's a place that doesn't have indoor plumbing, much less indoor banking. And he explained to me through in Swahili through a translator. He's a 73-year-old retired school teacher, decided to become an entrepreneur in his 70s. And he explained to me his name of his company. I love this, Rexel Industries, and it sounded like a multinational corporation.
Dreaming big.
Yeah, his business made ceramic stove liners, which is a cleaner, safer way to cook on an open fire. And he explained to me that even though he only spoke Swahili, that on his flip-top phone, he had figured out, learned how to apply for his loan, get his money, repay his loan. He'd done that twice, $1,700, that he had tripled the size of his business with those two loans, and that he'd become an entrepreneur because he had a dream of sending his six daughters to not just to school, but to college, and that Rexel was an acronym for the first letters of his six daughters. So when I met Erastus, I thought, if we can reach Erastus on his phone, which is literally like a $2 phone in today's, you know, in the world, I realized there's really nobody on the planet we can't reach. And that's when I started dreaming about, how do we reach a billion entrepreneurs? What if, you know, how do we do that? I think technology will enable us to do it. So he was sort of a window into the future in a very unlikely place.
Well, that's an inspiring story, not only of Erastus, but these others. And it may be surprising that when we think about those who need it most, that we're not just talking about people in remote villages, but as you mentioned, people here. In Silicon Valley, what gaps do you see that still exist for us being able to reach those who are yet unidentified, or those who maybe even in our backyard who do not yet have access? What are the gaps that you really see that government, individuals, individual people, corporations, organizations really need to focus on next as priorities?
So it's easy to think, for example, I don't know how many people know, there are like tens of millions of people in the US that don't have access to the internet. It's kind of a staggering fact. There's a great company, I think they're called Tazga, who is looking at providing internet access to kind of parts of the country that don't have it. So sometimes it's easy to forget in our own backyard. I think of the Bay Area. The Bay Area has sort of a tale of two cities in a way, you know, and it's, you know, you don't have to walk very far from here to get to a very different existence that people have. You know, in the Bay Area, I think one out of five children go to bed hungry. And so that was one of the insights we had actually right after the 2008 crash and the Great Recession, was that we really, at Kiva, we said, you know, we want to start lending in the U.S., and we want to help people understand that you can think global and act local, because if you think about it, small businesses are the lifeblood of communities, you know, whether the cafes we go hang out at, the stores we shop from, and they are really vulnerable. 8 out of 10 businesses since 2008, business loans get turned down. And yet, if every small and micro business in the country just hired one additional person, we'd have zero unemployment. They're also the lifeblood of job creation, but literally tens of billions of dollars that were going to small businesses since 2008 have come out of the market. So it's a big, big issue here in the States. And, you know, we don't have to go very far to educate ourselves about what that looks like and how we can sort of help advance. So this is part of the, I think we're having a consciousness-raising moment of how one of the things that when you have agency and you can sort of self-determine, make choices, we tend to sort of gravitate towards surrounding ourselves like surrounds itself with like, and so we have to sort of our challenge to figure out how we pop out of our bubbles and bring more diversity into our lives. And we don't have to go very far to do it, it turns out.
That perspective is really important, and it's a clarion call for us here. So we're thinking about the importance of entrepreneurship for the pipeline of jobs. That's something that's of vital importance, and one of the reasons that Exponential Center here at the museum is so focused on not only capturing the legacy of the past, but empowering, you know, next generation entrepreneurs. And I agree with you, the statistics show that businesses under 1 year old have been the pipeline for 3 million on average jobs a year. And it's the only way that we're going to solve this, as you talked about, this bulge in demographics where we need a billion new jobs by 2020. So as you think about that, some people say, well, businesses need to be focused on business bottom line, on profit. Mm-hmm. And others say, well, we need to have a more purpose-driven value. And some say those things are incompatible. And some say, well, we can't really do the social do-good kind of thing. We need to have a real business. What's your take on purpose and profit and the relationship there?
Yeah, well, you know, we've created a bit of a cognitive trap in a way about how we think about purpose and profit. And, you know, when we think with our hearts, we think in terms of charity and a handout. And when we think with our heads, we think in terms of profit maximization. And we've pursued that to a point of, you know, an era of, I think it's fair to say, hyper-capitalism that pursues profit kind of at any cost and perhaps at a great cost to our humanity. And so the question comes down, what is the middle path there where if you take the long, it's a time horizon thing in many ways. If you take the long view, purpose and profit actually align very well. And, you know, again, the change the world mindset here in Silicon Valley has fundamentally been about purpose. I think the most, we often talk about mission versus mercenary driven companies. We know both can be financially successful. We also know that mission driven companies tend to be better places to work. They tend to engender a fierce loyalty amongst and pride of identity amongst employees and customers. They tend to become enduring institutions and often, you know, the admired kind of society's exemplars. And so a lot of the most successful companies are, in fact, very purpose-driven, but we tend to view them through the lens of just pure profit, and we miss that part. You know, we look at Larry and Sergey's vision of, they didn't just set out to build a faster search engine. Mm. It's about organizing the world's information and making it useful and accessible to all. And, you know, that very much is a North Star for the company and it's expanded beyond. Or, look at Reid Hoffman and Jeff Weiner with LinkedIn, you know, the mission to create economic opportunity for a global workforce. Ev Williams and Biz Stone giving voice to the voiceless with Twitter. And, you know, I know a lot of these people, they're colleagues and friends, and I know that these are things that they take very seriously. And I think purpose and profit is fundamentally about if you take an active day-to-day when you're making business decisions, you're actively wrestling with what you're going to maximize, and you will maximize around purpose at times and defer on the profit-maximizing decision in the short term. I think the challenge that we have right now in sort of an era of quarterly capitalism for public companies is having to solve for that short-term profit-maximizing decision, which is when it can feel like you're at odds with purpose. But when you take the longer horizon point of view, they align quite nicely. I think we're being driven there by the millennial generation, and because they're putting their money where their mouth is in a very interesting way. You know, 9 out of 10 think companies should be measured by more than financial performance. I think 50% have actively not taken a job at a company because of values or conduct. And so they are, I think, in many ways, giving voice to the fact that we have a universal hunger for meaning. We want our work to be meaningful. They insist on a purpose-driven relationship to the companies they work for, buy from, and invest in, and that's a big deal because they are inheriting $41 trillion in wealth, and they just surpassed the baby boomers in terms of the largest generation ever. So I think we're kind of coming into this purpose economy where that's more front and center.
In this purpose economy, as an advisor, and you've been an advisor with so many different kinds of companies, what advice do you have for people who are leading companies that have that pressure, that quarterly pressure, as you say, the quarterly capitalism pressure, and yet still want to have a purpose-driven, they need to satisfy stockholders and also the value? What specific tips or advice do you have?
You know, it comes down to really having aligned investors. And, you know, if you look at, like, BlackRock, which is the largest, I think it's the largest fund in the world, the CEO came out recently and it was writing a letter to CEOs imploring them to think more long-term strategically. So this is an investor sort of saying, you know, we want you to think long-term. And so you sort of see this kind of growing enlightenment amongst investors, even on Wall Street. But having values or purpose-aligned investors makes it a lot easier. I think one of the reasons we've had this happen here in Silicon Valley is the capital tends to be more patient. We know that you have to pivot, you know, find your way to sort of, and so you have more time to kind of stay aligned with your purpose. You're not having to figure out how you're going to be profitable in year one. So it's really, I think that's kind of a critical thing in the whole equation. But the more enlightened investors do understand that it creates a much more solid foundation, so that not if but when the tough times come, you have people that are committed to staying there. They're there because, you know, the statistics around employee engagement are interesting. Gallup did a poll across 142 countries and found that 87% of people were either disengaged or actively or passively in their job. Mm. So that means that majority of us, work is a soul-killing experience. And at the same
time... Say that again, a soul-killing experience.
Sounds terrible, it's depressing. But the interesting thing is that purpose, more than money, more than status, ends up being one of the most potent and underutilized ways of driving engagement and performance in employees. And so, you know, there's quantification now happening around better performing companies or companies that have purpose. At the top line and the bottom line, the more profitable companies, they have better employee engagement, better performance, et cetera. So I think the more that gets quantified, the more it becomes part of the collective conscious.
You mentioned tough times, and in this kind of a long, long vision, there will be tough times. I'm curious to know about your own ability to face tough times. Have you had them in more recent years? And what's the nature of your resilience and this optimism that you have to be a force for positive change? Behind that, can you share with us some challenges that you faced and how you've overcome them and turned them into who you are now?
You know, I had a real crisis of faith moment right after one of my companies had been acquired, and it was this interesting schism of the peak of my professional and financial success, where I objectively should have been on top of the world, but my interior life was very different. I felt a certain emptiness, and that got my attention, and I thought, okay, you know, I can sort of go climb the next mountain, do another company, but why am I doing this? And that is where I began to understand some of the things I talked about earlier in terms of what was driving me, my sense of purpose, and I reconnected that with that in a deeper way. And so a lot of why I talk about purpose so much is that it has been a North Star for me, and it guides my day-to-day decision-making, my minute-to-minute, what I do, where I direct my energy. I'm always thinking about impact at scale, you know, how to harness sort of technology and my work to have impact at scale. So That was a very difficult period, and I didn't know where I'd come out on the other end with that. But now I know I go back to that that sense of sort of reconnected with my sense of purpose when I struggle. One of the things we talk about at Kiva that's fun is that whenever we're having sort of tough times, we go read borrower stories, and it always brightens our mood, and it reminds us sort of why we're doing what we're doing. And it's sort of an interesting counterintuitive thing, because oftentimes when we are facing adversity and struggling, and the thing about being an entrepreneur is you need to have a strong adversity muscle. That's fundamentally what it comes down to, which is why I think so many entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley are immigrants. You know, being an immigrant or going through that, it develops an adversity muscle. And a resilience. And you know, I look at like the Kiva entrepreneurs have more grit and resilience and ingenuity than the best entrepreneurs that we worship here in Silicon Valley. And I draw great inspiration from them.
So you got interested in it with her advice, a little bit of a way more accident. But what kept you in it? You were early as a woman in computer science. You not only stayed in with one company, but arguably a whole string of them. You worked with Lotus, Silicon Graphics, and others. What not only got you into it, but kept you in the field?
Well, early on, I discovered I didn't. You know, the way computer science was taught at the time, you had no idea really what the applied form was going to be. I was pretty panicked, thinking, "What kind of job am I going to have?" I didn't really know. It was also abstract. But I discovered, it was in the early networking days, and I discovered email in the lab. And something just sparked when I saw that. And this idea, I mean, email's old school now, but at the time, the idea that you could send a message to theoretically, you know, N number of people, that it could instantly reach them around the world. It was a revelation like Twitter and Facebook when they first came out. And something just said to me, you know, this is one day we're all going to communicate this way. And, you know, people thought I was pretty crazy. I went to work for Bell South right out of college, and Bell South was a very much sort of, you know, from the Bell Labs days, kind of pioneering around networking. And when I say that, people say, well, why wouldn't you just pick up the phone? And it wasn't a phone you carried in your jeans, right? It was like a phone on the, no one understood why you'd use email. But the thing that I think I realized that, that propelled me was it was inherently, it changed the power structure, that it could put a little bit of power into the hands of people who didn't have it. And it, you know, you could send an email to the CEO, you could send an email to, you know, so that's what really got me. So it was all about democratizing communication and enabling fair access and breaking down hierarchical structures.
You saw that at that early time in your lab? That's
oddly
amazing.
Enough, yeah, somehow. And, you know, I spent a lot of decades basically reimagining communication and collaboration and email kind of in pursuit of that.
Yeah. Entrepreneurs who are looking for advice, and earlier tonight I asked if you had a word, one word of advice for entrepreneurs, what would it be? I'd like you to share that with us, and why. Are you ready? So, Julie, you've chosen the word dream. Tell us why.
Because one dream can transform a million realities, and that's all that really ever has. And that's probably, you know, that's probably the most hopeful truth that I know. And dreams certainly played a role in my life in kind of helping me dream of a better world. So I think that my hope is that as we think about how we align our dreams for our own lives and our dreams for technology and business and align them with a dream for all of humanity, and when we contribute to that virtuous cycle, we can teach every man, woman, and nameless child to dream, and maybe in the course of doing that, we can give back to the world a portion of its lost heart.
We'll close tonight thinking about how education can support global entrepreneurship. And to drill that home, what can teachers and educators, what's most important for them to be teaching to support the next generation of entrepreneurs?
I think it's about mindsets, actually. I think it's less about skills, and I think it's more about mindset. So, you know, again, are we teaching the next generation to be comfortable with ambiguity and uncertainty? Mm-hmm. Are we teaching them to be risk tolerant, to be able to, because they're not, are we teaching them to be creative? If necessity is the mother of invention, scarcity is the mother of innovation, is what I think. And so sometimes we think the more fertile ground we give people, the more they're going to, and it's the opposite. You know, there's this idea you starve your way to success, at least in the early days, because starving is very focusing. And so I think a lot of this has to do with, is there enough adversity in the environment for you to develop the adversity grip muscle, the resilient muscle, that if you hit a wall, you get discouraged, that when everybody else sees the wall, you see the crack and you're already chipping away at it to bring down the wall. Are we teaching people those kinds of mindsets? I think that's the fundamentally the most important. Are we giving them enough unstructured time to really develop the part of the brain that governs sort of long-term strategic thinking to solve complex problems? Are we training them to expect fast answers? And I think we're in a world that has a gravitational pull around all those things, and so how do you counter it in the way that we kind of indoctrinate and educate people? I think it's actually more of an issue in the West, by the way, than, you know, a lot of these things are naturally built into the environments in other parts of the world. It's in the West where we sort of, in Norway, those of you know me know my better half is Norwegian, but in Norway they have this term called curling kids, where it sort of speaks to a style of parenting where the parent is out front sort of brushing the ice to remove all friction for their kid. It's sort of the equivalent of helicopter parenting here, but it's like, you know, are we really doing them a favor by doing that, or is it better to actually throw sand on the ice and give them, you know, help them figure out how to deal with friction?
So. Well, Julie, it's been such a pleasure and a privilege to have you here. On behalf of the Exponential Center here at the Computer History Museum, I want to thank you and ask all of you in giving a very warm thank you to Julie for her insights and inspiration tonight. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was technologist and entrepreneur Julie Hanna. Next episode, you'll hear from Planetary Resources CEO Chris Lewicki about asteroid mining and the future of space exploration.
What really excites me every day about what we're doing is having the opportunity in the next 10, 20 years for space to be a place not just for astronauts, not just for billionaire space tourists, but for a place where more and more people live and work and play.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of CHM Live Radio. This podcast is produced by Lauren Miyamoto and me, Chanel Lauren. John Plute composed our intro music, and transitional music is provided by Lee Rosevere. You can learn more about our events and the museum at computerhistory.org.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.